cold wind was blowing from the west when Falcon McAllister stepped into the warmth and glow of the Palace Hotel lobby. The lobby occupied one-fourth of the ground floor of the two-story building. The remaining three-quarters opened off the lobby through a wide-open archway with a gilt sign proclaiming diners, was a big dining room served from a busy kitchen. The place was packed. At every table and bench, men, women, and children dined on beefsteak and fresh bread, while others stood along the walls waiting. A dozen or so harried-looking women with starched bonnets and long aprons hurried in and out through the back serving door, carrying platters. Falcon's stomach growled appreciatively at the wafting aroma of freshly baked bread. It was a while, he realized, since he had eaten any decent cooking but his own. But he had things to do first. At the lacquered desk, the night clerk watched him approach and open the registration book. Any man carrying saddlebags, duffel, bedroll, and a rifle was obviously a customer.
I need a bed for the night. Private room if you have it. And I'll want one of those beefsteaks in there.
Room's $1. Clean sheets and 2 oil lamps. Privy's just outside. And there's water on the washstand. Diner's charge is separate.
Falcon signed in, glancing at the names on the register.
You know any of those people who just come in?
Yeah, those are wagon people. Homesteaders, mostly. They come in all the time, but just for a meal.
Big, smudge-faced man lounging at the end of the counter had been looking Falcon up and down.
That's a big iron you carry there, mister. Know how to use it?
Well enough. Here's your $1. Which room is mine?
The clerk handed him a key on a brass ring.
205. Upstairs on the left.
Falcon turned toward the stairs. The smudge-faced man scowled and straightened.
I believe I was talking to you, mister.
Go talk to someone else.
Without a backward glance, he went to find his room. Falcon glanced around the little room, then tested the bed and judged it acceptable. He stripped down, washed himself at the washstand, then put on a fresh shirt from his pack and cleaned his hat and boots. The dark broadcloth suit in his duffel was a pleasant change from worn buckskins. He shaved, put it on. Finally, he cleaned and oiled his .44s, strapped one on, and shoved the second into his waistband. By the light of an oil lamp, he retrieved a little oilskin package from his saddlebags, unwrapped it, and sat for a moment gazing at its contents. Then he dropped it into a coat pocket and went downstairs. It took Falcon only a few seconds to spot the wagon crowd. They were seated at 3 tables near the front, working on platters of steak and potatoes.
Is there someone here named Blanchard?
At the nearest table, someone turned. A young man, sturdy and clean-shaven, accompanied by a young woman and a little boy.
I'm Tom Blanchard. Who are you?
Falcon McAllister. Are you Owen Blanchard's brother?
That's right.
McAllister hesitated. He hated what came next, but there was no alternative. Removing his hat, he handed Blanchard the oilskin package.
This is yours.
The package contained all that Falcon had salvaged from the massacre out in the Colorado Gully. A Bible with names and dates, a piece of map, a battered clasp knife, a scrap of lace, and an ornate locket of inset ivory hearts and a gold oval. They were things the outlaws had somehow overlooked. Every other personal item he had found out there was either blood-stained, ruined, or destroyed. He had buried all that with the victim's remains. Tom Blanchard stared at the salvage, his shoulders going stiff. Beside him, his wife gaped.
I'm sorry. I found him, what was left of him. They were robbed and murdered by outlaws.
Owen, my God, where, when?
All of them, Ruth and the children too, and Bob Sims?
In a quiet corner of the hotel lobby, Falcon related what he had seen and what it meant. The Blanchard sat huddled, too stunned yet to grieve, while others from their wagon party gathered around. The clerk was asleep at his counter, and there was no one else around at the moment except people coming in and going from diners.
I buried him proper, Then I pick up the trail of their wagon. I think I know where those men were going.
How about the law? Aren't there sheriffs or someone to deal with those monsters?
Law spread real thin out there in the slopes. Where those men went, there's no law at all. I'll send a report to the authorities in Denver as soon as the telegraph opens tomorrow, and you can contact them too. Don't expect much, though. There ain't much they can do.
But those men, you say you know where they went?
I think so, and I'm going after them. I'll need to know how to contact you if I can recover your brother's property. I'm very sorry about what happened to your brother and his family. Nothing's gonna make it right, but I promise you those men won't get off scot-free. Let's just say I've seen way too much of their kind. I guess I just can't tolerate anymore.
The cold night wind was as bleak as Falcon's spirits. There was music and laughter coming from a place across the street, and he headed that way, wanting to shake off the dismal memories of lonely graves on the Colorado plains and of the grief his news had brought to the Blanchards. The memories were pitfalls, leading down to the aching emptiness that his wife's death left. Spiro's saloon offered a rowdy haven and gaiety in a cold, hard world. Falcon needed a drink. He spotted a few familiar faces in the crowd. Jack Cabot and Sandy Hogue were at a gaming table off to one side with several other men, and he saw a little knot of soldiers from the fort keeping to themselves in a far corner. Falcon stepped to the bar and ordered a whiskey.
Why, here's the gent that don't talk to common folks.
Falcon turned. It was the tough from the hotel.
You turned your back on me once before, mister. Nobody insults John Moline a second time!
I've had enough of you.
Whatever Moline may have been expecting, bluster or a move to draw, he wasn't ready for what came next. Moline abruptly found himself doubled over with a fist that exploded like a mule's kick into his belly. He went white and bent over, and another fist came from down around the knees to cartwheel him backward. Tuff sprawled on his back, bleeding from broken lips and nose, and Falcon stood over him. With a quick swoop, he hauled Moline's gun from its holster, emptied its chamber, and cast it aside.
You picked a real bad time for a chat.
Every eye was on Falcon. He looked around, sizing up the crowd one by one, then rested his cold gaze on the side table where Cabot and Hogue sat.
Anybody else?
When there were no answers, he went back to the bar and downed his jigger of rot gut. They dragged the unconscious Moline out of the place. Falcon looked around again. Cabot and Hogue were gone, as well as a dozen others. Three tables had emptied. Billy Chalice and Tuck Kelly were miles southwest of Dodge by the time dawn touched the prairie sky. They had gone up to Dodge on a whim to nose around and maybe get drunk. But at Spiro's saloon, they had heard the talk. A big yellow-haired man with a big gun was on the war path. He had blood in his eye, and he was looking for the men who took a prairie schooner over in Colorado. They heard it from an eavesdropping hotel clerk, from talk among homesteaders, from Sandy Hogue and Jack Cabot, from Fort Gossip. Oh, they heard about Falcon McAllister. The man was a legend, but now the legend was real and taking a personal interest in Asa Parker's game. And he knew just where to look. The pair rode toward No Man's Land, and others joined them for the ride. At Crooked Creek, Billy Chalice turned upstream where a bare-limbed cottonwood grove offered some shelter.
Let's hold up for a while. I'd like to get a look at that yahoo Cabot's been talking about.
From the Western Union Terminal at Denver, a coded message was rekeyed to Kansas Pacific's private wire and received at the Division Land Office in the Waring Building. A garter-sleeved clerk delivered it to Sebastian Wiley. Wiley composed a list of questions and dispatched runners to the Denver Constable's Office, the courthouse, and the resident federal marshal. Within the half hour, he had a copy of Falcon McAllister's telegram reporting the burial of murdered homesteaders in the southeast foothills. Armed with this, He took McAllister's latest message and rapped at the door of J.R. Horner. Together, they peered at the message.
Translate, please, Wiley.
It's from Falcon McAllister, Mr. Horner. We can be fairly sure it's authentic because of the survey code shorthand. It was sent from Dodge City, Kansas. He says six men and a stolen conveyance are bound for some place called Wolf Creek in the Neutral Strip. He is pursuing them. He says to see the authorities in Denver regarding robbery and murder of someone called the Blanchards. I've done that. The federal marshal confirms a report from McAllister of finding a family of movers dead and robbed.
Well, does this have something to do with our missing land money?
I can only assume it does, sir. Otherwise, why would he tell us about it?
Then the six men he reports are the same who stole our money, Asa Parker and his men? Do the authorities verify this?
I don't see how they could at this moment. Apparently, McAllister thinks they are. But what if they are, sir? How do we proceed? There are no legal authorities in the Neutral Strip. That's no man's land.
We are a railroad, Wiley. Private enterprise with government sanctions to conduct our business as we see fit. We don't have the limitations of law. If there is no law, we make our own.
Horner turned to a big section-gridded map on the wall. He stooped to peer at its lower right corner.
The Neutral Strip. South of both Colorado and Kansas, buffer between Kansas and Texas, runs from Black Mesa and the Cimarron breaks on the west over to the Indian Territory's east. Well, there's nothing shown here, Wiley. No features at all.
No, sir. As I said, the Neutral Strip is no man's land. There's nothing there, officially.
Well, it's all outside of our grants and bounds. That region is all CRIP territory. Julius Randolph's domain. Lordy, wouldn't that son of a bitch love this if he heard about it? $9,000 in Kansas Pacific currency straying over into his claims. I guess to protect myself, I'd better notify the U.S. Bureau of Transportation about the robbery and all.
They already know, sir. We've had an inquiry from a Mr. Cipher about it. He also inquired about our broadcast alert for Mr. McAllister.
Oh, he did he? Nosy functionary, isn't he? I assume we haven't responded?
No, sir. Private dealings within the company are none of the Bureau's business. Not unless we choose to make them so.
Very well. Establish contact with Mr. McAllister. Advise him that I...
Mr. Horner, sir, I don't know how to contact him. He's left Dodge City, and the only working wire beyond that is a place called Hardwoodville, out on the Cimarron. There's nothing in the Neutral Strip.
Then find him! Find him, Wiley! I want this matter resolved before the Transportation Bureau calls in federal marshals. My God, Randolph could swing votes with this. He could make me a laughingstock. Our stock would drop by half if word got out that we had set bounty on persons or properties within the claimed jurisdiction of another railroad. The CRIP would love to take over our land rights. So would ATSF. They're both bargaining right this minute for transcontinental privileges.
But this is simply a matter of recovering stolen property, sir.
That stolen money came from public funds, Wiley. Right now it is unaccounted for and out of my control, and this McAllister has no more credentials than a bounty hunter. I want you to find him and get him on our payroll. Make it clear that he is working for the Kansas Pacific in this matter.
I'll try, sir. Do you really think he'd trade a finder's share of $9,000 for railroad wages?
Oh, damn the wages. He can have the whole $9,000 if he recovers it. Just don't let the Bureau or Randolph get to him first. Find him, Wiley! Do it! In the meantime, I'll notify Julius Randolph and the CRIP that we have an agent in pursuit of felons somewhere between Dodge City and Texas. Our agent, an employee of a legitimate railroad business.
Falcon McAllister was completely unaware of the political turmoil seething in his wake as he topped out on the great swell of grassland south of Crooked Creek and headed into the sand hills above the Cimarron's North Bend. He had covered nearly 40 miles since leaving Dodge City, and his eyes ached from hours of squinting into bright skies across distant horizons. The land was wide and empty, with the illusion of featureless prairie. Since leaving Dodge City, he hadn't seen a sign of civilization. It was as though the westward advance of progress ended where the rails did. Mile after endless mile, there had been no sign of humanity. It was an illusion, though. Out here, a man could see forever, but much of what was there was hidden. For 10 miles, he had known he was no longer alone. For the past hour, there had been riders behind to his left, careful to stay out of sight. To the hunter's eyes of Falcon McAllister, though, they were noticeable. He didn't know how many there were, but he guessed who they were. A bunch of drifters, toughs, and bounty hunters who had left Dodge some hours ahead of him. They must have holed up somewhere, waiting for him to pass. Whoever they weren't friendly. For most of the ride up on the flat plains, that they were there had been just a fact to note. Matter of curiosity. They had kept their distance, but it was sunset, and the sand hills offered more cover than empty prairies. The riders were crowding in, getting closer. He knew they would show their hands soon, and it would be at a place of their choosing. It was likely that Kate and Hogue were among them. It didn't matter much who the rest were. He had let Diablo set his pace, pushing the followers hard. They would be expecting him to stop soon. 40 miles was a long day's ride. In the twilight, he saw the sandhills spreading before him, ancient dunes now covered with sparse surface grass, but still contoured by centuries of ceaseless wind. They would be marking time out there, guessing at how far he would go before making camp. They would be thinking about an ambush. He saw the spot they would likely choose. A mile ahead rose a high crest that stood like a slanted wall across his trail. He would head for it. Making camp below that dune out of the night wind was what any tired man might do. Setting an ambush there was what any outlaw bunch would do. Neither was what Falcon had in mind. The rising of a dune hid it from any spotters to the east.
Let's make this interesting, sport. See if they mean business.
To anyone watching from the surrounding crest, the rider disappearing behind the lone dune was a weary traveler plodding one last mile before supper camp. What came into view on the other side, half a mile south, was a fresh racer at full gallop. Falcon had covered 300 yards in full view and was still gaining speed. Like black thunder, Diablo flew down the trail and the rising dune came to meet him. The old dune was 80 feet high. A slipping, sliding ridge of compacted sand, barely clad in thin, sparse clumps of grass. In the flare light of sunset, shadows faded and features were obscured. Falcon let Diablo select his path. At a sharp angle they climbed, rivulets of sand cascading behind him. Falcon let the horse climb nearly to the top of the dune, then tightened the reins and turned it. Bounding and skidding, they descended the slope, straight down to its face, and Falcon guided to the left. He had left plain trail to the top of the dune, but in the dimming twilight, his descending trail, several hundred yards to the west, left no visible track at all. 20 minutes later, Falcon crawled on his belly to the crest of a scoured-out dune and looked toward the long ridge. There were at least 15 riders over there, a few at the top, the rest scrambling upward. Against fading light, they were barely more than shadows against the sand. Those at the top had halted, milling here and there, straining to see into the darkening valley beyond.
Where'd he go? I can't see a damn thing.
He's down there someplace. Someone get out a glass, look toward the river.
Oh, hell, Billy, I don't see anything out there. The son of a bitch just disappeared.
One by one, the shadows converged at the crest of the dune, then vanished over it. Time passed. Falcon McAllister rested himself and his horse. There was little graze in the sand hills, but a handful of grain and a hatful of water kept Diablo content for now. McAllister's supper was pemmican and water. With darkness, the winds turned cold, but he made no fire. He wrapped himself in his sugans and allowed himself a hunter's nap, dozing an hour with his senses alert. 2 hours after the riders had passed, McAllister crossed that same rise, the rim of the sandy lands, at a different point, and paused at the crest. It was full night then, but the silvery glow of brilliant High Plains starlight lit the land. From the high crest, he could see vague patterns in the sandy swales below, pale patches where hooves had gouged the grass and stirred the sand in passing. Even by starlight, the trail pointed like a road sign, saying where the riders had gone. Falcon nudged Diablo down the incline. At the foot of it, he cut west, then southwest again. Only a fool would ride a fresh trail of men who hunted him. He followed the trail, but he took his own path, and it was aside, taking advantage of the terrain for natural cover. A mile or two along, he found them. Their night camp was pitched in a trough among the sand hills. Beyond, the land sloped toward the valley of the Cimarron. He left Diablo in a little cove just above and west of the gang's camp and went in on foot. Most of the gang were asleep around the embers of their cook fire. There was a small group at the fire, all facing the low-burning flames. They felt the safety of numbers and had set no guards outside the camp. Using the cover of the rolling, windswept dunes, Falcon slipped close. At 30 yards, he could make out faces in the firelight. The few still awake were staring into the fire, mistaking darkness for shelter. He recognized a few of them, faces he had seen at Dodge. One of them he knew by name. Sandy Hogue was still awake near the fire. Falcon knew the Jack Cabot was there, too. Watching the men around the fire, it was easy to spot the one who controlled the gang. A short, barrel-chested young man with the shoulders of a wrestler and the eyes of a snake made it clear by his posture that he was in charge. Falcon studied him closely. Long hair hung wild below his flat-crowned hat, and the firelight lit a face that might have been a child's, a round-cheeked, beardless face with only a little stubble, a face that seemed designed for laughter until one looked again at those cold, slitted eyes in it. Instinct told Falcon that this was no kid. This was a dangerous man, far more dangerous than most of the toughs and saddle tramps around him. In the shadows just away from the fire, another one who didn't seem to fit lay sprawled on a sand slope, resting on a saddle as if it were a 40-pound pillow. This one didn't join in the talk, but Falcon had the feeling that these two were partners. Where Babyface went, the quiet one would be there too.
That's a new one on me, Billy. You sure do spin a yarn.
Then he heard a few words of conversation on the faltering wind and learned a name. Babyface was called Billy. Falcon cataloged them all in his mind. Billy and his quiet shadow, Jack Cabot and Sandy Hogue, two or three more from the table at Spiro's. The rest were saddle bums, fiddle-footed bad men along for the ride, and maybe a share in whatever came to hand. There were 13 in all. Falcon spent an hour in the gang's camp, slipping from one point to another, listening and sizing them up, before he decided he had learned all he could. Cabin and Hogue might have set this bunch onto Falcon's trail, or some of them might be thinking of that private bounty that someone had advertised. Mostly, though, the bunch was heading for no man's land, to sign on for wages with someone called the Colonel. Billy and his partner were encouraging and directing him. Someone in no man's land was paying top dollar for gun hands, and among the words Falcon heard were Wolf Creek and Paradise. Falcon was watching from a distance when the gang headed out at dawn. They scattered out and circled for a time, looking for his trail, then began drifting southwest by twos and threes toward the Cimarron Valley. He lost sight of them for a while, and when he saw them bunched again, they were half a mile away. Patiently, he lay concealed atop a dune and counted them. Then he counted them again. There were only 11 now. He scanned the surrounding lands and watched the gang until they were out of sight, but saw no sign of the missing two.
Damn!
Falcon crouched and ran, heading for the only cover in sight. Another bullet kicked sand in his face as he dove into a shallow wash screened with sparse bone-white grass, tried to see where the bullets had come from.
Shit! Oh, shoulder.
Falcon flattened himself, counted 6 heartbeats, and rolled aside, belly down, and several feet from where he had been. Hanging his hat on the muzzle of his rifle, he held it at arm's length and raised it slowly, only a few inches. This time he saw where the shot came from. The shooter was 150 yards away, firing from behind a comb-like ridge. Now he knew where the missing outlaws had gone. Without returning fire, Falcon edged farther to the left. There was a small shelter here, a foot-deep depression under the shallow swell of the sand. He kept low and out of sight. Then he waited. Moments passed. Then, on that comb ridge out there, the shape changed. A line in his rifle. Falcon saw the dust spray as his bullet struck. He didn't think he had hit anybody, but he had given him something to think about. He rested his rifle on cold earth, braced himself, and waited. They would have to show themselves to shoot, and now he was ready. When the shots came, though, they were from his left, and the first bullet almost flattened him as it smashed into his ribs. Like a coiling snake, he swiveled belly down and emptied his magazines at the disappearing silhouette atop a rise 100 yards away. Long, wild hair waved beneath a flat-crowned hat as the sniper was hit, but continued moving. He stumbled, swayed, then was gone. Falcon struggled to reload his .44-40. The gun felt unusually heavy, and his fingers were awkward. Glancing down, he saw blood spreading, seeping through the cold sands beneath him. Too much blood.
Oh, damn it.
He began a methodical fire and fire again. First at the knoll to the north, then at the rise to the west, then north again. Bullets tore up the ground. The morning light wasn't bright enough. His vision was dimming from shock and lost blood. He fired, waited a heartbeat, and fired again as flitting shadows flicked along the crest of the north dune and disappeared. Falcon was hit bad, and he knew it. His only hope now was that the ambushers didn't know how bad. Staying flat, he got out his knife and cut a wide strip from the bottom of his buckskin shirt. He rolled over, wrapped the cured hide around him. He could feel the hole in his side, way around to the back. He could see the one in front, a gaping, bleeding tear just above the waist. Awkwardly, he leveled another round into the chamber, then laid the rifle down to pull the bandage tight with all the strength of both hands. It was slippery, soaked with his blood, but he managed a tight knot. Drawing his belly gun, he pushed its muzzle under the buckskin on the right side, then twisted it there. The pressure of the binding sent flaring agonies through his left side, almost blinding him with pain, but he held the twist in place. Then he gave the gun one more cruel push and snugged its butt into the loop of his belt. He was still trying to work the lever for another shot when darkness closed in on him, shutting down like curtains all around. The buckboard wagon was no ambulance, but Jude Mason handled it like one. Blacklands farm boy grows up handling teams, hitches, and loads. He learns the feel of the leads, the sway of the bed, and how to avoid sudden bumps. With strong fingers, he manipulated the traces, guiding the buckboard up the long, undulating slopes with the river behind him and the high plains still miles ahead. He eased around the washout while Jubal clung to the plank seat beside him. Behind, the horses on leads skipped this way and that, finding footing. Just behind the seat, Jonah crouched in the wagon bed.
Easy, easy, Jude. Lordy, you just going out of your way to hit every bump there is?
Get out and ride your own horse if you don't like it. I'm doing the best I can.
There were 6 of them in the party. Brett Archer was out ahead, riding lead and setting the pace. 2 others, Johnny Lawrence and Buck Tiber, rode flank, keeping pace with the buckboard. Jubal and Jonah had tied their mounts on behind with the found horse and now rode the pitching wagon with their brother. Of the 3 Mason boys, only Jonah, the youngest, was distinguishable, mostly because of his age. Jude and Jubal, twins, were alike as peas in a pod, 2 sunburned farm boys cut from identical cloth. Now Jubal turned to look back at their kid brother.
Just hang on, Jonah. Try to keep that fella from bleeding. We still got a ways to go, but it'll smooth out once we're past these wash banks.
Jonah relaxed a little and turned his attention to the sleeping man sprawled among the expedition's luggage. A big man, his hair matted around his ears, he lay untroubled by the bumpy ride. The fresh linen wrapped around his middle showed a little blood, but no more than before. Though he looked as pale as death, his breathing was regular. He had been deathly pallid at first, and they had feared he would die during the night, but he had held on somehow. A smaller bandage covered a bullet burn on the man's shoulder, and a dozen small scabs were forming on his face, neck, and hands where flying pebbles had nicked him. The main wound, though, was high on his belly. A bullet had struck him low in the left back and had come out in front, leaving a jagged hole that bled profusely.
Why are those Jaspers shooting at you, Mr. McCannister? They run off when we showed up and we never saw where they went. Rhett figures they were some of that crowd that pulled out of Dodge last morning early. Why do you suppose they took you on that way?
The man's head rested on the saddle they had taken off the black horse, and the horse plodded along on lead with their own mounts. Brett Archer had thought he might ride the big black today to rest his own horse, but he had changed his mind about that. The stranger's horse wouldn't be ridden. At their noon stop, they had debated turning west for a few miles to deliver their burden to the settlers at Hardwoodville, but they decided against it. The man called McCallister was still alive, and all they could do at Hardwoodville was bury him. He stirred a little now and then, struggling, and they got some thin stew into him. He went back to sleep.
We'll go on with him.
Archer's dark eyes went moody and fierce as he fingered the little inlaid and ivory gold locket in his hand.
Maybe he'll come around before he dies. From what we heard in Dodge, Mr. McCallister's our best hope of finding those damn snakes who killed Dorothy and her family.
That blacksmith at Dodge said something about a medical man who had staked a claim at Horse Spring, right near the strip line. I say we stop there and get this gent looked at. Lord knows I'm no doctor, but if we need him alive, let's get help.
The Mason brothers were cousins of Tom and Owen Blanchard. Hardly a word had passed among them that evening when they stood by as Falcon McCallister delivered his news to Tom Blanchard. Owen was dead. He, his wife Ruth, his daughters Dorothy and Tess, and Ruth's brother Bob Sims. Outlaws had killed him, and McCallister was going after the outlaws. At that moment, the three made up their minds. Where outlaws could go, they could go, and their guns would be loaded. They might not be able to keep up with the man on the black horse, but they could follow. Buck Tiber and Johnny Lawrence were cousins of Sims, and they went too. Of the six, only the Virginian, Brett Archer, was not kin to any of the victims. And what drove him was strong. His reason was Owen Blanchard's oldest daughter, Dorothy. The locket the stranger brought, ivory hearts and gold, was Dorothy's. Brett Archer had given it to her before her family set out from Neosho, and he'd promised her that he would follow. So now they turned south at Hackberry Ridge, and Archer rode ahead. Jubal and Jonah took turns nursing the wounded man while Jude drove the buckboard. They had set out from Dodge, thinking to follow his tracks. Now, without his tracks to follow to lead him to the killers, they needed him. As the wagon cleared the rutted wash to smoother ground, Jonah looked again at their passenger. The man looked more dead than alive, but he was still breathing.
You've got the fortitude of a stud bull, Mr. McCallister. By rights, that back shot should have killed you, but looks to me like you're still fighting.
They found Horse Creek, and they found the medical man, a horse doctor named Lincecum, who changed the dressings on McCallister's wounds and shook his head.
Yep, reckon he'll be dead by night. If it was me, I'd be. But if it sets out to mend, get him back here and I'll take another look. And get him back if he commences bleeding again.
At mid-afternoon, they topped out on the southwest rim of the valley, and Brett Archer came riding back to call a halt. As always, his presence was a sobering influence on the rest of them. Even though he was barely past 20, the dark-haired Virginian was an educated man with a touch of sophistication that the College of William and Mary provided. He had a smooth maturity about him, and a manner that made a man keenly aware of the pair of dragoon colts that lurked beneath his dark coat. Rumor had it that Brett Archer had killed a man, maybe more than one, in a stand-up duel back east before migrating to the Neosho Valley, where the Blanchards met him. Certainly there was a dark, brooding quality about the young man from Virginia. Still, although the ominous rumors persisted, the people on the Neosho found no reason to shun the Easterner. His manners and appearance were above reproach. Quiet and solicitous, Brett was a decent enough young man. He had a fine manner, and he was always courtly in his dealings, a gentleman through and through. But he was not a man to be pushed. Archer looked down at the big man sleeping.
He's still alive. Keep him covered with those quilts, Jonah. The wind is cold. Has he said anything?
Not a word. Thought a couple times he might be coming around, but he just lays there.
Loss of blood. It's like shock. Lord's wonder he's still twitching. Keep feeding him that beef stock whenever he'll take it. While we're resting here, let's have a look at that map the blacksmith drew. The state border is along here somewhere. Beyond is the neutral strip. Let's see if we can determine where Wolf Creek is.
Falcon awoke to the sight of starry skies seen through a broken roof and the smell of coffee. He turned his head, squinting at what seemed to be the remains of a crude sod cabin. The roof was partly caved in. The strap-hung door was aslant, and the two little windows gaped open, shutterless. The soddy looked as though a conquering army had marched through. The only shelter it offered was from the cold wind, but the baked mud hearth still kept a fire. Falcon lay beneath piled quilts on a rickety canvas and stick cot. The only light was the fitful glow from the hearth, where several men huddled together. He tried to raise himself to sit up, and pain lanced his midriff. Beside the cot, a figure stirred.
I think he's awake, fellas.
A moment later, there were young men all around him, looking down at him.
You'll be all right, Mr. McAllister. You remember getting shot?
The memories came back, and he nodded, gritting his teeth against the pain that seemed to envelop his entire left torso.
Where are we? Who are you?
We were there when you told Tom Blanchard about his brother's family. We're kin. This place is an abandoned soddy. Looks like squatters built it, then moved on. We're somewhere in no man's land. You know who shot you?
I got a name and a face. A hard case named Billy Challis. I guess the one with him was his pard. What happened to him?
Don't know. I guess we interrupted them. When we came up, they fired a few shots our way and we shot back. Then they ran off. One of them was sagging like he'd been hit.
We got hot stew, Mr. McAllister. Best you eat some of it if you can. I'm Jude Mason, and these are my brothers Jubal and Jonah. That's Brett Archer there, and Johnny Lawrence, and Buck Tiber. Right now, let's see if we can get some stew into you.
Did you find my horse?
He's in the corral with the rest of the stock. The beast tried to kill me. Why do you keep him?
Don't take it personal. Diablo doesn't tolerate anybody much, but I like him.
Spring of 1881 was a peculiar season, even by High Plains standards. The thaws came early that year in the lands east of the Rockies, earlier than anybody could remember. With them, they brought windstorms, sudden rains, flash floods, and whirlwinds, topped off by an unseasonably warm weather that brought the buds out on the cottonwoods and gave a greenish hint to the pale, eternal grass. Then, in late March, as though to emphasize that this was still the High Plains, it turned around and snowed. There was a patched-up roof on the soddy by then, and oilcloth laced over windows and door. There was even a shed of sorts for the horses, though the snow that fell was only mush snow, big wet flakes out of an overcast sky with almost no wind. The wound in Falcon's belly was scabbed over and healing, but he still felt as though he had been kicked by a mule.
I expect you got a cracked rib or two. Probably gonna hurt like hell for a month. You're lucky. Most men would be dead from a wound like that.
Day by day, the aching, the sharp pain every time he moved, diminished. By the end of a week, he was up and about, sweating in the cold as he gathered winter hay on the meadows above the stead. By the time the snow fell, he was breathing easier and had a crib full of hay stored in the shed. But sometimes sharp pain shot through his chest when he turned abruptly or moved the wrong way. Sometimes the agony doubled him over and left him pale and shaken. Big flakes were drifting down when Brett Archer rode in from a long scout. Blanchard kin were scattered around, tending stock, hauling deadfall wood from a lightning-felled cottonwood by the creek. Falcon sat on a fence rail, cleaning and oiling his 44s. Brett hauled rein near him and stepped down, glancing at the sky. His hat and shoulders were white with snow.
I've been to Wolf Creek. That's where they are.
You sure?
Uh-huh. I know Owen Blanchard's wagon, and I know who's got it.
You're determined to take a hand in this.
Falcon ran a scrap of cloth through the 44's barrel, scrubbed oil into its cylinder, and reloaded.
We all are. Those animals killed Dorothy. When you found the remains back there in Colorado, when you found Dorothy, they violated her, didn't they?
Falcon looked away. Some things were better left alone.
There's some yucca pods on that broken rail over there. Can you see them? How good are you with that gun? See if you can knock.
Glancing away, Falcon hadn't even seen Archer draw. But on the rail, 50 feet away, a yucca pod exploded into dust.
Oh, that good. How about you?
Damn.
Falcon limped over to a stump and sat down. His tanned face was drawn with pain, his eyes squinting, and his brow wet with cold sweat. He was weak and shaky. The effort had cost him. But when he thrust a hand inside his shirt, it came out dry. He wasn't bleeding, at least.
It ain't fancy duels out here. It's the last man standing. When you start something, finish it.
What the hell's going on? Sounds like a war.
Masons and cousins came from everywhere at the noise, guns out and ready.
Mr. McAllister, you look like hell.
Just getting acquainted. Brett's been to Wolf Creek. Let's boil some coffee and hear about it.
They gathered in the soddy to hear the news.
Wolf Creek is southwest about 10 miles. There's a settlement there, mostly lean-ups and tents. But there are some real buildings going up. A couple of false fronts with a mercantile and a beanery, and a two-story hotel. All kinds of soddies and cabins. I saw a couple of new corrals, a hay barn, and a big pole barn that's being used for an office. Half a dozen plank and barrel saloons, a canvas top gambling hall, and a whole cluster of whore cribs.
A real town. Does it have a name?
I heard the land agent call it Paradise. It must be 100, 200 men around there just in the town. Border trash, mostly, I guess. 20 or 30 of them are a local law of some kind. Yellow bandanas. Vigilance committee, they call it. The headman is a big slick gent by the name of Colonel Amos DeWitt. He headquarters at a covered wagon, right in the middle of everything. There's another bruiser by the name of Obermeyer. He heads up the vigilancers, him and a buzzard called Casper. There's a hard case named Folly Downs that's in close, and a couple of others I didn't see. But the six of them, DeWitt, Obermeyer, Casper, Downs, and the other two, they all arrived together a few weeks ago. It's their town now. They just moved in and took over. The rest around there hired guns, drifters, and a few settlers looking for land.
I expect they got gun hands.
They do. Real hard bunch. They all wear those scraps of yellow to mark them, like a uniform. This place draws hard cases like honey draws flies. Those vigilantes would as soon shoot a man as look at him, and they look like they come from all over.
Any place there's law and order, probably. They drift here because there ain't any law.
You got that right. There's probably dodgers on every one of them. I recognize two or three. One of them is Jean-Paul Calumet. You ever heard of him?
Canadian. A slick man with a gun. He was hunted out of Canada for murdering half a dozen men. He drifted down the Mississippi, ran with the Lawler bunch for a while. Calls himself a duelist, but the law calls him a cold-blooded killer. What's their game here?
Selling land. The pole barn is a land office, and the agent is a flim-flam type named O'Brien. Looks like DeWitt intends to build quite a town there on the creek. They're selling town lots instead, and DeWitt's promising a railroad.
What kind of covered wagon did you see? Overland?
Yeah, a big prairie schooner, rigged for 5-span. And he has the stock for it. It's Owen's rig, fellas, right down to the gouges on the gate.
That's them, then.
It's them. There was a quilt, Aaron, on the line. It was the same quilt that Dorothy and Tess were working on when they left Neosho.
You went right in? Right in close?
I moseyed all over the place. They probably took me for a homesteader or a buyer. You're right. The murderers are there. I'm sure DeWitt's one of them, and Obermeyer, and Folly Downs, and Clarence. With the two I didn't see, they call them Billy and Tuck. That makes 6.
Land sharks. Speculators turned pirates. DeWitt, that could be Asa Parker. That ties in with O'Brien and the patent deeds he peddles. No man's land. No legal ownership of anything. So who's to say who can sell what, as long as the seller has possession?
Yeah, they don't have to buy land to sell, they just take it. But it's more than just a land swindle. Judging by the money DeWitt's laying out for guns, I'd say it's a high-stakes game.
This cabin, did you see any neighbors around here anywhere?
Nobody close. Down along the creeks, there are squatters, some of them pretty well dug in, but not up here. Mostly just places like this. Abandoned cabins, lots of them empty, some of them burned out. Some places that might make good farms, but the squatters who started them are gone. Nobody around.
Vigilantes, hired thugs and assassins. They scout the territory and clean out occupants so that land shark will have farms to sell. It only works if the shark has a good base of operations and plenty of bullies on payroll.
And good bait to bring in customers. DeWitt selling town lots and quarter section plots, but the railroad is what brings them in.
No better bait than that. You own property where a railroad goes. You're a rich man.
You see anybody rich in Dodge City?
No. Nor any original owners either, I bet. They took their profits and headed for better places.
Wolf Creek sounds like a big operation. He'd have to have someone inside the railroads to back it up, and plenty of capital. Did the Blanchards have money with them?
Not much, I guess. Owen sank everything he had into that prairie schooner and his draft team and supplies.
Well, there's money at Wolf Creek. I saw more cash money floating around there than I'd ever seen outside a bank.
Falcon couldn't help thinking about the telegraph message that had been waiting for him at Dodge.
Railroad money. Stolen money from the Kansas Pacific. That's their investment capital.
And Owen Blanchard's family just happened to get in the way.
So what are we gonna do about it?
We go to Wolf Creek. We leave now so the snow will cover our tracks.
Yeah, and get yourselves killed. You said yourself there are guns all over the place. And only 4 of the 6 are there.
We can get them. You're right, though. There are guns all over the place. Most of them working for DeWitt.
Find the rest. You only saw 4 of the bunch. 4's not enough. Let's put them all down. We'll look around some more.
You aren't up to it, Mr. McAllister. We've seen how you are. Something's busted inside you, and it hasn't healed yet. Besides, some of those yahoos will know you on sight. You'd stand out like a sore thumb.
You boys won't. You go in. I'll be around. I want to see those claimed places down on the creeks. Maybe get to know some of the neighbors.
Where God puts water and the means to subsist, no matter how meager, no act of Congress will keep people away. The neutral strip between Kansas and Texas, that long rectangle of land that would someday be known as the Oklahoma Panhandle, was created by oversight. Some said it was to pacify the Indians forced into the territories to the east. Others said it was intended as a buffer between Texas and Kansas following the War of Northern Aggression. And there were some who held that in the blood frenzy of post-war federal politics, the U.S. Department of the Interior simply overlooked it when the Plains lands were designated for settlement. Whatever its origin, the neutral strip was a rectangular void in the spreading cloth of the United States. A hard day's ride across from north to south, closer to a week from east to west, it straddled the central plains from the Indian territories to the breaks of the Purgatoire and was entirely devoid of any semblance of law. For some, it was a land of opportunity. Where there is no law, a man can take what he wants, sell what he can deliver, and hold what he can defend. South of western Kansas was such a place. called it No Man's Land. Fresh and wet melting snow lay a foot deep along Wolf Creek when Colonel Amos DeWitt, the man once known as Asa Parker, opened the hind flap at the tail of the prairie schooner and looked across at a freshly whitewashed building. Even with its paint, it was little more than a converted barn with a high loft, but it and the new hotel just down the way were still the most impressive structures in the squalid little town sprawling around it. Quick-eyed men with yellow scarves on their shoulders and shotguns across their arms glanced toward him as he buttoned up his coat and snugged his hat tighter around his head. Near the off-rear wheel, where a stretched canvas made a roof over some benches and a chimneyless pot-bellied stove, Folly Downs glanced up from his whetstone. DeWitt wrinkled his nose in disgust. Folly had never been much to look at, but he was hideous now. The scabs had peeled away from his ruined cheek and ear, but that was no goddamn improvement. The bullet scar across his cheek gaped like a second mouth off to the left of his nose, and Clarence's needlework only emphasized it. Folly had a hand-sized piece of rough, hairless hide laid down on a bench and was slicing it to make a hat band. He called it squaw hide. He wouldn't be the first to decorate himself with pieces of dead Indians, but a hat band cut from a squaw's breast was unusual. At DeWitt's frown, Folly nodded and sneered. DeWitt disappeared inside the wagon for a moment, bolted down the strong box. Then he reappeared, righted the wagon's gate ladder, and descended to the ground. Guards in yellow scarves around the wagon cradled their guns and nodded, and the two nearest the tailgate moved aside for him as he stepped down.
Afternoon, Colonel. Looks like the snow's stopped.
Here and there, other heavily armed citizens touched their hats, raised their hands, or otherwise saluted the big man in the fine coat. Most of them also wore the yellow cloth of the Vigilance Committee. And only a few weeks since his arrival, Colonel Amos DeWitt, Asa Parker, had staked his claim on everything within 30 miles of this place and made it stick. It wasn't just the fact that DeWitt owned everything around there by right of force, or that he paid most of them good wages to protect his interests, that earned him this show of respect. As much as anything, it was fear. The former Asa Parker was a big man, more than 6 feet tall, and as broad and solid as a woods boar. Despite his natty attire, he had made it well known around there that he brooked no insolence. Among men who understood violence, he had made a point to establish himself by doing his own chores when it came to punishment. A smashing fist was something these men understood. A six-gun was something they understood even better. Colonel Amos DeWitt had demonstrated both in lining up his organization at Wolf Creek. DeWitt paid well for the services he bought, and he paid in cash. But over by the bluff, just across the creek, were mounds of freshly turned soil testifying that Colonel DeWitt was a man who accepted no excuses, tolerated no interference, and didn't hesitate to kill. Still, dressed in the finest broadcloth suit, starched linens, and spotless outerwear, he was a match for any banker or politician. With a brief nod, DeWitt acknowledged them all and squinted in the bright gray light of day. Across the rutted street, men on ladders were hoisting a big canvas pennant into place on the front of the pole barn, and DeWitt studied it critically. The bright paint was a nice theatrical touch for the drab building and the motley snow-covered piles of salvage that surrounded it. Stacks of lumber, piles of battered furniture, mounds of rusty hardware and stained tools, limestone blocks, and a huge stack of cut cedar posts with a sign on it. Fence posts, 5 cents each. On the building front, workmen hammered nails into the canvas banner, stretching it taut as they went. The sign read, Paradise Land Company, Town Lots, Building Sites, Commercial Investments, Colonel Amos DeWitt, Proprietor.
Is that how you spell commercial? C-O-M-M-E-R-S-H-A-L? It doesn't look right.
I guess so, Colonel. I'm no hand at spelling.
And what's this paradise business? I thought we were calling this place Prosperity.
O'Brien changed it. I don't know why.
DeWitt scowled at the sign once more, then turned as Kurt Obermeyer and Casper Wilkinson walked toward him. Obermeyer was as big as the colonel, but of a far rougher cut, and even the paid constables and vigilance committee members who did DeWitt's bidding tended to stay shy of him and his ever-present sawed-off shotgun. Obermeyer was, plain and simple, one big mean son of a bitch, and he looked it. Wilkerson, by contrast, was a hawk-nosed beanpole of a man, more draped than covered by the long coat he always wore, a coat that concealed considerable armament.
Riders coming in. Maybe some more boys from over in Kansas.
DeWitt shaded his eyes. Riders were just pulling into the far end of the settlement, three young men on tired horses. With the distance and the collars and mufflers they wore against the cold, he could see no faces. They seemed like ordinary drifters, young bucks on the run or on the prowl, not particularly noticeable.
They're nobody. If they're looking for work, they'll find Kurt. Obermeyer, what about the bunch Billy and Tuck brought in? Can we use them?
They'll do for gang work. Most of them can use a gun. I got Calumet drilling them. I'll try some of them out tonight.
All right, they're up to you. Anybody else new today?
The usual. Couple of immigrants with O'Brien's deed plasters. Few drifters sightseeing. The only one looks like he might have money. Young fella named Archer. He was around here a day or so ago. Now he's back. He's over at the post, last I saw.
Archer. Well, see if you can herd him toward the land office. Maybe O'Brien can sell him something. What was that ruckus I heard a while ago?
Oh, that Squatter Coleman that had that cedar camp out on North Rim. He thinks he's a hard man or something. Raising hell about the boys running him off that land last week. Should have shot him out there instead of just running him off.
Damn squatter should have just moved on. What do we get from his place?
Mostly those cedar posts yonder. O'Brien had them hauled in. Think he can sell them? I bet it took that squatter a year to cut them posts.
We got us some plain lumber, too. Maybe a wagon load and some wolf hides. There was a pair of mules out there, but they weren't worth chasing, so the boys shot them.
And the squatter's still around? Some folks just don't get the message. Stupid. Where is he now?
He was out here hollering about being robbed. Don't know where he is now. Maybe down in the cribs or holed up in one of them sidies. He's still around somewhere, I guess. You want someone to go find him?
I don't want him shooting off his mouth when there's customers in town. Just tell the boys to keep their eyes peeled. And speaking of customers, I don't want Billy on the street for a while. The way he's been carrying on since he killed that gunfighter. What was his name? McAllister. Tell Tuck to keep that rooster under wraps for a while. He's bad for business.
Billy's out at Spring Place sleeping it off. He's got a bullet burn that'll keep him tame for a day or two. Tuck's watching him.
Turning his back on him, DeWitt walked across the slushy street to the land office. Inside, Clarence O'Brien was tacking up a big hand-drawn map. It was a gaudy thing, full of official-looking lines and notations, covering an area of perhaps 900 square miles, and with a painted star in the center. Beside the star, in detailed calligraphy, was the word Paradise. Angling down toward it from the northeast was a wide red line with the caption, Atlantic to Pacific Central Railway. A separate map on another rough wall was an elaborate detailed drawing of a sizable city lined with streets and alleys, none of which existed outside the minds of the speculators, and all blocked out in rectangular segments representing town lots. Its label read, Paradise. O'Brien was a slick-looking, natty-dressed jaybird with a huge wax mustache and an air of courteous authority. He could, they say, sell anything to anybody and make them truly believe, for long enough to part with their cash, that they'd made a good deal.
Impressive as hell. Why Paradise?
I had to call it something. All the town deeds have that name, and the country tracks are Paradise Valley.
He opened a drawer, pulled out a stack of official-looking document forms, and displayed them.
I picked these up at Newton. Printer there does nice work.
Whatever it takes, let's just get the damn acreage sold. Cipher needs documented landowners to swing the railroad this way.
No problem. There's a sucker born every minute. Soon as the roads thaw, there'll be customers showing up. I've got a cash buyer coming from Winfield, interested in that bottomland section south of here. Hackberry Meadows. I hope it's unoccupied when my buyer gets here.
It will be. Obermeyer's going out there tonight. We're through trying to reason with the Barlows.
Good. I'll mark it clear. And you might tell those hoodlums of yours, sorry, those Vigilance Committee gentlemen, to keep it quiet around here, Colonel. Cash buyers don't like to hear people holler about being robbed. Makes them nervous.
DeWitt was inspecting the maps when a ruckus erupted outside. Followed by O'Brien, he stepped out onto the narrow plank walk.
What's going on?
Across the streets, his guards had pulled in around the wagon as men ran past him heading west. Beyond the crowd, Folly Downs waved at him.
Fire, Colonel! The hay barn's burning!
Well, go put it out! I'll keep watch here.
The fire was visible, a writhing column of smoke 200 yards to the west. Within moments, the town in front of the land office was practically deserted as crowds gathered around the blazing sheds. DeWitt stepped down from the walk, shooed O'Brien back inside the land office, and glanced around. He was almost alone in this section of the street now. Almost, but not quite. A ragged figure had appeared beside the cedar stack and stepped toward him.
DeWitt! You owe me! You owe me for my land, my cabin, my mules, my cart, and for these cedar posts! You're a thief and a robber, DeWitt! You and your men, you're nothing but night riders! You owe me, and I expect to be paid!
You must be Coleman.
Coleman's fingers twitched above the butt of the big gun in his belt.
I want to be paid! You damn sharks have ruined me! Now you owe me!
I don't carry cash around with me. The money's all locked away. Maybe we could discuss this later.
Pay up now, or by God, I'll kill you! Even that's better than you deserve!
I don't owe you anything, squatter. You squatted on land that wasn't yours, cut posts that didn't belong to you.
Coleman's fingers clawed nervously, closing around the gun butt.
Why, none of it belongs to you either! Now pay up, I won't say it again!
I guess not.
Carefully, he spread his arms wide away from the .45 at his belt. It was a gesture of surrender, and Coleman responded. His hand dropped away from his own gun. Then, with a movement too quick to follow, DeWitt's right arm swung forward. His hidden derringer slid from his sleeve into his hand. Coleman staggered and gaped as the slug tore through his chest. He tried to pull his gun, but he failed. The second shot took him through the wishbone. The man was dead before he fell. At the sound of shots, faces turned in the crowd 200 yards away, and yellow scarves flashed as several of Obermeyer's Vigilance Committee regulators came running, guns drawn. In the background crowd, half a dozen men, hard-bitten farmers who had been hanging around town, exchanged glances and drifted away.
Clean up this mess. I suppose he's the one who set the fire. Has Folly got it put out?
Several of the thugs stepped back, looking around.
Folly? I thought he was here with us. Hell, I guess he's still at the fire.
They found Folly Downs an hour later, behind the burned hay barn. He lay face down in the muddy slush churned up by earlier crowds, his body riddled with bullet holes. It was no casual shooting. It was a methodical execution. Small, precise holes decorated the corpse. Throat, groin, shoulder, knee, and chest. It was as though each shot had been planned, each bullet intended to punish before destroying. An execution with no sign of an executioner.
I ain't going out tonight, Asa. Billy was right. There's been someone trailing us since Colorado, and now he's here.
Casper Wilkerson hovered nearby, backing him up. The three stood alone just behind the closed gate of the overland wagon, while yellow-banded vigilantes kept the traffic away from them.
You're spooked. You're downright scared. You can't even remember to call me Colonel DeWitt. You're so scared.
I ain't scared. But you saw what happened to Folly. That wasn't any natural shooting. I got a bad feeling that we're being stalked. And it's just the three of us here now, with Billy laid up and Tuck with him. I don't intend to go riding out to let some sniper get me.
He might be right, Colonel. We ought to keep close till we get to the bottom of this.
I'll send Jackson and Calumet out with the vigilantes. They can handle those Barlows. I say we stay close together for now. and here in town where we can watch one another's backs.
You're both damn fools. Whoever killed Folly is gone.
We'll stay anyway. Maybe Kurt's right, maybe not. But I'd hate to see anybody left all alone with this wagon and the money that's in it. Might just be too much temptation there.
Did Jackson and Calumet know what's to be done?
They can handle a few damn squatters.
Then send them. But I want that claim clear. And I want Billy and Tuck back here as soon as possible.
Billy stove up bad, Colonel. That bounty man he shot put a bullet into his butt. Tuck's staying out there with him.
Billy and his private business. Well, get him back as soon as you can.
Brett joined Jubal Mason and his brothers at the Paradise Hotel.
This place is a pure hellhole. When I tell you boys, I've seen about enough of it.
Pacing the plank floor, he glanced out of the smudged little window. Beyond, evening light across the bluffs cast a bleak, smoky glow over the town of Paradise. Out by the corral, Sam Jackson and the man called Calumet were assembling some of the vigilantes. It looked as if at least 20 riders would be pulling out soon, heading south.
Obermeyer's not going. How are we going to get to him and those others if they stay inside their guard circle?
Well, we got one of them anyway. Nice going, Brett.
Wasn't me. I wish it had been, but it wasn't. I don't know who killed that son of a bitch. I thought maybe one of you boys got him.
Three Masons exchanged surprised glances.
You didn't kill Folly Downs? Then who did?
I sure don't know.
Well, how about that fire at the hay barn? Didn't you set that?
Wasn't me. I was over by Owen's wagon trying to get a look inside. Couldn't get near it, though.
Then who did all that? Wasn't any of us.
Place like this could have been anybody. But I never saw anything quite like it. Did y'all see that corpse? That Jasper was shot to pieces.
Yeah, I had a good look. Back home, I'd have said somebody used him for target practice. Those weren't pistol shots in him. Those bullets were small caliber, high power loads, like a squirrel rifle. God, back home the law'd have posses out combing the country. But all those vigilantes did was drag him off across the creek along with that fella their boss man shot. They're both laying out in the snow out there, waiting for someone to bury him. What kind of law is that, anyway?
Law? There's no law here, Jubal. Just the criminals in charge. And I'd say they make up near half the population. Did you see DeWitt gun that settler down out there? That was nothing but cold-blooded murder with a hidden gun. The settler never had a chance.
I listened around. The way I heard it, Obermeyer's vigilantes ran that fella off his land and stole his posts. When he came in to complain, DeWitt shot him. DeWitt carries a .45 in plain sight, but he never touched it. He shot Coleman with a sleeve gun. Like you said, the poor fool didn't have a chance.
No man's land. No damn wonder it's called that. This whole place is nothing but a hellhole.
You been out to the place? How's McAllister coming along?
He's on his feet. I don't see how, but he's talking about taking a hand at the Barlow place. Swore he'd get a saddle on that big black if it killed him. Maybe it did. We left him there.
Outside, the light was dimming. It would be dark soon. With a final glance from the window, Jubal put on his coat and hat and drew a yellow scarf from his pocket. With Jude's help, he fastened it to his lapel.
I better make tracks if I'm going to catch up with the vigilantes. Wish me luck.
Jude was fishing out his own yellow banner.
I'll be along directly. I'll try to stay back and see if I can find some way to back your play, Jubal.
What play? Nobody we're going after is going out there tonight. Best we can do is maybe even the squatter's odds a little.